from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area students are heading back to school this month amid news that an increasing number of parents have opted not to vaccinate their kids. The number of unvaccinated children in California has tripled in the last decade. Nearly 10% of kindergartners statewide last year didn't have all of their required immunizations, and in Marin County, only 82% of kindergartners were fully vaccinated. To fight this trend, a Marin pediatric practice with 8,000 patients has refused to treat those who aren't vaccinated. Public health officials have launched information campaigns, and a new state law requires parents to consult with a doctor before opting out of vaccines. A well-known bioethicist is even proposing lawsuits against parents who refuse to immunize. We'll talk about efforts to pressure parents to vaccinate their kids next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. California is one of many states that allows personal choice for parents who wish to be exempt from vaccinating their children. There's much concern about these exemptions as kids head back to school because of the numbers, which are going up, especially in affluent areas of the state. And there's concern focusing largely because of what medical researchers call herd immunity and the rise in preventable diseases from non-vaccination, a subject that we have certainly taken up in the past here on Forum. But this month, the California Department of Health has launched an immunization managing portal and an assembly bill, which will go into effect in January, that will require consultation with a healthcare practitioner before a personal exemption can be claimed. There are many vexing questions around the issue of vaccination. Since non-vaccination increases the likelihood of the spread of disease among other children, should parents who refuse to vaccinate their children be open to being sued or arrested? Should pediatricians be permitted to not treat patients, as some have decided to do, who are not vaccinated? And these and other questions are in the mix of this hour as we focus on vaccination as a public health issue. And joining us here in studio is Dr. Nelson Branco. He's a practicing pediatrician and managing partner in Tamalpais Pediatrics, which is in Marin County. He and his practice recently made it clear that getting the MMR vaccine by age two is a requirement for care, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thanks. Good morning.
We also have Arthur Kaplan with us by phone this morning. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Language Medical Center. He's up in the Poconos of Pennsylvania, and we met at the Siebel Scholars about a year or so ago. Arthur Kaplan, good to have you on Forum. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we also have Catherine Martin with us this morning. She directs the California Immunization Coalition, a nonprofit public-private partnership dedicated to full immunization protection for Californians. Welcome, Catherine Martin.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And we also want to welcome Barbara Lowe Fisher, who will be with us for a segment in this program. She's in Leesburg, Virginia, and she's president of the National Vaccine Information Center, NVIC. It's a national charitable nonprofit educational organization dedicated to the prevention of vaccine injuries and deaths and to defending the informed consent ethic in medicine. Welcome, Barbara Lowe Fisher.
Thank you.
Glad to have all of you. And Arthur Kaplan, since you've created a firestorm here, I thought I might begin with you. And that firestorm is over the idea that parents who essentially refuse to vaccinate their children or opt out and vaccinate their children should be essentially, or we need to consider whether or not they should be liable for prosecution, even for homicide prosecution, let alone for litigation and being sued.
Yep. And the reason I wrote an article and sort of put this idea forward is I haven't seen people try to hold those who choose not to vaccinate accountable for the consequences of their action. So we know that it is getting possible through epidemiological means, sometimes through genetic means, to figure out who was the person who made somebody else sick with the measles or with whooping cough or with other diseases, and sometimes produced a death. We're getting better at doing the causation of who it is that might have infected someone else. We also know that some of these people have chosen not to vaccinate, and I'm not against, I'm not trying to argue that we eliminate the ability to choose not to vaccinate, but what I'm saying is, even when you make that choice, and even when it's made under a state-allowed opt-out provision, it doesn't allow you to go to the daycare center or walk into the neonatal unit or behave in a way that's reckless or that endangers others. Just as we've said, you know, you could smoke, but it can't blow into my face, or you could have a swimming pool, but you better put a fence around it. Your right to do what you want if it impacts others and if it causes harm or death, it doesn't release you from liability.
And that includes people who make the choice for religious reasons, presumably?
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly people out there who can't vaccinate because of health reasons. I wouldn't try to hold them accountable. You can't ask them to take a direct health risk, whether it's an egg allergy or someone who's undergoing cancer treatment, that sort of thing. But personal choice, religious choice, you can make it, and you have to understand that that's going to limit what you can do, where you can go as a result.
And there is presently a rise in preventable diseases because of the decline in vaccination rates. Have we determined that incontrovertibly?
Absolutely. It's amazing to watch the outbreaks, measles outbreaks, whooping cough outbreaks, flu epidemics, and you can trace many of these to communities where non-vaccination decisions predominate, and then people expose others because they haven't been vaccinated. They go somewhere where measles is endemic and bring it back in. We are having a renaissance of diseases that once we had under control, because not so much that the general population chooses not to vaccinate, but pockets of people do. And when you get below herd immunity, when you have a lot of people in a small community or a region deciding not to do it, that really opens up the door for these diseases to come back.
And what about, and we'll hear later from our guest who is opposed to actually curtailing in any way the kinds of things you're talking about through prosecution mm-hmm. or whatever. But the argument comes down to, for many of those who are defending their right not to vaccinate, that there is not enough efficacy in terms of studies and that pharmaceutical companies have great interests here.
I think pharmaceutical companies have an interest. I wouldn't deny it. It's certainly the case that they want to sell vaccines, but it is much better, as most people understand, to do prevention rather than it is to do therapy. So if you have a HPV vaccine that can help limit the spread of the virus that causes cancer, it will make the manufacturers of that vaccine some money, but not vaccinating makes hospitals a lot more money because they have to remove the cancers or take out the precancerous tissues. So in general, we know that prevention is a better strategy to take in terms of cost than therapies. If drug companies made more money selling prevention and less money trying to sell drugs to treat things, I'm not sure that's a bad trade-off.
Arthur Kaplan, again, is director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center, and Catherine Martin is director of the California Immunization Coalition. And Catherine Martin, a lot of the difficulties that you faced in trying to get people to immunize their children really go back to England. So let's talk about that for a moment. We've talked about it before here on Forum, but I'm talking about, of course, the Andrew Wakefield case, where he published an article in Lancet linking autism to vaccinations, and that article was essentially retracted by Lancet, and they claimed it was utterly false, and he was his license was revoked. The CDC has said that there is no connection between vaccines and autism. I think we need to get that on the table here, don't we?
Absolutely.
So why does this continue to be, in many people's minds, a link? I mean, you can't necessarily read people's minds, but how? So maybe just because of too much of the Internet propagating it? Or what do you suspect is behind this?
Right. The bell was rung and you can't unhear it. When the Wakefield study came out and linked, potentially linked MMR vaccine to autism, that information was spread and kept spreading until it was debunked. But people weren't listening to the stories that it was not correct, that it was a bad study. And they did not listen to when the Lancet retracted it and the authors disassociated themselves with it. What they heard was that message, that incorrect message. And so now we've been spending a great deal of time going back and re-educating parents about the importance of vaccinations and the safety of vaccinations and the impact that they've had. And one of the big challenges we have is that we don't see those diseases anymore. You know, you point to a classroom full of healthy children, a playground of happy kids, and we forget that years and years ago, some of those kids got polio. They got measles. They got mumps. They were home with chicken pox for weeks. We forget about that because it's not happening as much anymore. Parents think that these diseases aren't there anymore, or they're in a very faraway country and it's not not a risk to them anymore. So we have that study that was debunked, but they heard about it, they got scared about it, and then heard about it from celebrities who believed it as well. They spread that misinformation. So now we're going back to educating and reassuring and making sure that parents have credible information, encouraging them to talk to their providers about what's best for their child.
Celebrities, including Jenny McCarthy, who will be one of the participants in The View, and that has also caused another firestorm. But a lot of this concern was over mercury being in the vaccines, and it's my understanding that vaccines have been without mercury in Europe for years, and the autism rates have not gone down.
Correct. And I think Dr. Bronco or Dr. Kaplan may be able to address this a little bit as well. But the issue of thimerosal, a preservative that is in some vaccines, no longer in almost any of the vaccines except for some versions of the flu vaccine. But people took the terms mercury, and mercury is toxic, but there's ethyl mercury and there's methyl mercury. Ethyl mercury is a component of the thimerosal preservative, and that is not toxic to in the levels that it is in the vaccines. But it becomes very confusing when you start talking about those details and those components of the vaccine. There's lots of parts to a vaccine, and individually it sounds scary unless you speak with somebody who understands the science and can explain the science very well. But if you just hear that it's got these components in there, it can be concerning. And
well, it's also concerning because there are a lot more components that have been added through the years. And this is why a lot of the people who are opposed to routine vaccination have been up in arms. They feel that there's been a quantum increase.
That's a good point. And I think it's because we do have access to so much information now. We parents, and I myself is included, educate ourselves about the things that we put into our body. And I think because we have more information, there's more concerns. And I think that's a very good thing. But I think also parents need to make sure that they're using credible sources and using physicians and healthcare providers, healthcare resources that are come from credible sources and can explain these vaccines in a competent manner.
But you can understand parents saying, I don't want to be told what to do with my children, and I'm concerned about my children's safety, even if they're dead wrong. Nevertheless, it's easy to empathize with parents who feel that way, isn't it?
I think it's important to have a respectful conversation with your healthcare provider, whether that's a naturopath, even if it's a chiropractor, a physician. We, as a coalition, we work with many physicians. Pediatricians are in this business to take care of children, and they spend a lot of time talking to parents about vaccines. And yes, it is scary if you read about these components of vaccines if you do not understand them. And we try very hard to make sure parents have those resources to talk about them. The thing is, we do have a lot more vaccines, and that's a good thing. And Dr. Kaplan was talking about, vaccine companies make money on this, but yay that we have these vaccines, that we have companies that make these vaccines that save children, and they do not make as much money on these vaccines, these pharmaceuticals, as they do on pharmaceuticals that treat for other diseases.
I also don't know how many pediatricians are making money off giving vaccines. Let's get Nelson Branco into this.
Exactly.
He's a practicing pediatrician, managing partner of a practice in Marin County, and you've essentially taken the hard line on this, right?
Yeah, we've decided in our practice that we were going to draw a line in the sand with the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. And that was in the spring of last year, and we did that for various reasons. One of the reasons was because we practice in Marin, and the rate of personal belief exemptions had doubled since 2005. It's currently almost 8%.
And you need 95% for herd immunity. So it's down in Marin to what, like 84% or something?
It depends on how you look at the numbers. The rate of families who have some personal belief exemption is down around 84%. Sorry, and of course, people who are defending their right will say, just because I have a personal belief exemption doesn't mean that I've opted out of all vaccines. And that is true. And I think lots of pediatricians supported the new law that families have to discuss their personal belief exemption with a healthcare provider, simply so that a personal belief exemption wasn't a paperwork issue. I'll sign this so that my child can go to school today, and really so that they could make sure that they had good data on vaccine safety and the importance of vaccines in preventing these diseases.
Well, what do you say to those who will argue that you're punishing the children for a parent's decision, that children are innocent and they shouldn't necessarily be withheld from getting a vaccine if it's to their health or the health of their community?
Well, we thought long and hard about our policy, and there's no mistake that we made this decision in the spring of 2012. We had rising rates of personal belief exemptions. Some areas of our community, up to 50% of the children had not received vaccines. We looked at all the vaccines, and of all of them, we decided that the measles, mumps, and rubella was the one that was worth drawing a line in the sand on, simply because of how communicable measles is, how potentially serious it is, and also because it was very clear that that was the one that had generated the most controversy. There were, you know, lots of anecdotes on the internet that families had heard. 15 years ago, when I began practicing, and you know, my first practice was on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico, and there was, even on the Navajo Reservation, in the days pre-Facebook, there was a lot of concern about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. Since then, there have been many, many studies, and trying to explain to parents anecdote, which is something that I think is powerful. Personal stories are very powerful, but anecdote needs to lead us to study and lead us to look at data. And since then, there have been many, many studies, large studies in several different countries of not only thimerosal but the MMR vaccine that have shown that it's safe and it's not linked to autism.
Although there still are pediatricians out there who are opposed to vaccines and who are on board against vaccines, I'm also wondering what your thoughts are about the notion that there may be a medical ethic problem here. I mean, in terms of wanting to serve patients. On the other hand, you know, doctors can say and have said, if you don't trust me on this, how can you trust me to give medicine to you on any or to your children on any level?
Trust is a huge issue, and certainly trust is the foundation of any relationship, such as we have, where we're giving patients advice. I tell parents all the time, my job is to give advice and make recommendations, and your job is to make decisions, and we do that together. When we made our policy, we looked at some CDC recommendations and some data on the fact that the London Olympics were coming up. There were rising rates of measles in the United Kingdom. In 2008, there were almost 1,400 cases of measles in the United Kingdom with two deaths. In 2012, there were 2,000 cases. The Euro Cup soccer tournament was happening in the Ukraine. There were rising rates of measles there. We live in Marin. There are people in Marin who travel all the time. In the United States, we had seen
You should also footnote this by saying the rates are highest in wealthy communities of exemption with vaccines. Malibu and Marin lead.
Yeah, and you know, followed closely by Boulder, Colorado, and Ashland, Oregon, some parts of Portland. There was a Seth Mnookin who wrote a book called The Panic Virus, tells an anecdote of talking to a public health person who he asked, you know, where are the highest rates of personal belief exemptions? And he said, if I find a map and put a pushpin around the whole at every Whole Foods, I'll find the high rates of personal belief exemptions. And you can understand why folks who are wealthy and educated, they have access to a lot of data. They're very careful about what they feed their children, what they dress their children in, and so they want data and information.
And there are legal excuses again. I mean, children can be too young. There's vaccine shortages. There's lack of access to a medical facility. There's kids having chemo. I mean, there's some real reasons behind not vaccinating. As opposed to what may be questionable reasons in many people's minds for opting out.
Absolutely. And actually, that was a big part of our decision as a practice. We have children in our practice who are receiving chemo, who are on immune suppressive medications for arthritis, for asthma, for autoimmune diseases, and they're in our waiting room. In 2008, there was an outbreak in San Diego. 11 children were made ill. Of those 11 children, four of them were exposed to measles in their doctor's waiting room. Three of those children were under 12 months and too young for the vaccine. We didn't want that to happen in our waiting room.
Well, let's bring Barbara Lowe Fisher into this. She's president of the National Vaccine Information Center. And Ms. Fisher, I'm glad you're with us from Leesburg, Virginia. I must tell you straight out, without creating any unnecessary friction here, that it's been very difficult. We wanted parents to come on here and speak, parents who presumably are very strongly in favor of opting out of vaccines and have strong feelings against routine vaccines and immunization. And it was very difficult, to put it mildly. We got a lot of protesting and a lot of refusals. So I don't want to begin there, though. I want to begin by, from what you've heard here, and I know you don't want to necessarily be in a debate with the people who are on the panel today, but from what you've heard here, what have you heard that's wrong?
Well, I think it's important to remember that you can get vaccinated and still get and transmit infection. Vaccine failures are quite well known among public health officials, especially with pertussis vaccine, for example. The B. pertussis whooping cough outbreak in California in 2010 primarily occurred in vaccinated children because we know now that the pertussis organism has evolved and the vaccine is not very effective, so vaccine protection only lasts for a few years. In fact, the CDC states on its website that unvaccinated children are not to blame for whooping cough increases that we're seeing today, because it's a vaccine failure and not a failure to vaccinate. We have a very high vaccination rate in this country with pertussis vaccine. And there are effectiveness problems with influenza and mumps vaccines as well. But I think, you know, it is also important to remember that vaccines are pharmaceutical products. They carry a risk of injury or a risk of failure that can be greater for some than others. And the fact that vaccines, you know, can cause brain inflammation and even death, it's been known since the first vaccines, smallpox and rabies, were produced. And in 1986, Congress passed a law, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, that shielded drug companies and doctors from vaccine injury lawsuits. More than $2.7 billion in federal compensation has been paid to children and adults who've been hurt by vaccines. So the debate today, you know, really isn't about whether vaccines can cause harm. The Institute of Medicine published a series of reports between 1991 and 2013 confirming that fact. The debate today is about whether parents, and really all Americans, will have the legal right to make informed, voluntary vaccine choices that may not conform with government recommendations.
So what do you do with the research, empirical and pretty convincing, about herd immunity and increasing the likelihood of disease among young people? I mean, if you have a baby that dies because vaccine rates are down, how does that weigh on your conscience?
Well, I think you have to look at herd immunity and understand that herd immunity with, for example, pertussis vaccine is really a combination of naturally acquired and vaccine-acquired immunity. As I said, you can be vaccinated for pertussis and still get and transmit the infection. And I think this is not factored in when we're talking about herd immunity. So to punish those who may have very good reasons, including reasons for genetic or biological susceptibility to having vaccine reactions, to punish them for not, for example, getting pertussis vaccine after their children have already had a severe reaction to the vaccine, and you cannot find a pediatrician who is taking a no-exceptions approach to vaccination. You can't get a pediatrician to write a medical exemption. It's a problem. I mean, these exemptions, the personal belief exemption in California is extremely important for families who cannot find pediatricians to write a medical exemption after the child has had a serious health deterioration after vaccination. And I think that this is often not talked about in these discussions. Most parents who contact the National Vaccine Information Center in the last three decades, most of them want to vaccinate. The problem comes in when you have a health deterioration after vaccination and that child becomes disabled permanently or dies. The parent then is put in a position with other children that they have. What are they going to do? If they can't find a doctor to work with them and be compassionate and not take a one-size-fits-all approach to vaccine policy.
Let me interrupt you for a minute because we're coming up on a break. We'll come back to you after that break. I want to remind you, we're talking about vaccination this hour. You can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area students are heading back to school this month, and they do so amid news that an increasing number of parents have opted not to vaccinate their children. The number of unvaccinated children in California has tripled in the last decade. Nearly 10% of kindergartners statewide last year didn't have all of their required immunizations, and in Marin County, only 82% of kindergartners were fully vaccinated. To fight this trend, a Marin pediatric practice with 8,000 patients has refused to treat those who aren't vaccinated. Public health officials have launched information campaigns, and a new state law requires parents to consult with a doctor before opting out of vaccines. A well-known bioethicist is even proposing lawsuits against parents who refuse to immunize. We're talking about efforts to pressure parents to vaccinate their kids, and why are vaccination opt-out rates rising, and will efforts to turn the tide work? And you can join us and lend your voice. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786, or email us forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. We also asked on Facebook, how did you come to your decision about vaccinating or non-vaccinating your child? And I'll read some of those responses forthwith, but I want to let you know who's with us. Arthur Kaplan, the bioethicist I alluded to, is director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's with us by phone, and so is Catherine Martin, who is director of the California Immunization Coalition. Dr. Nelson Bronco is here with us in studio. He's a practicing pediatrician and managing partner of that Marin County Pediatric Office I alluded to, Tamil Pius Pediatrics. And they recently made getting the MMR vaccine by age 2 a requirement of their care. I have Barbara Lowe Fisher on as well, and she's president of the National Vaccine Information Center. They're a national charitable nonprofit educational organization. And I want to give you every opportunity to state your case here, Barbara Lowe Fisher, although, as I said, I would have preferred also having a parent on, and we had a hell of a time rousting one up. But let me ask you, just to finish what you were saying before we had to go to the break, and then please address, if you would, whether you think it's in the best interest of children to simply be, well, let me rephrase this. I want to be delicate about my phrasing here. What about keeping kids from medical practice because of the danger of disease to other children?
Well, first of all, I am a parent of 3 children who are grown. But, well, I think that, you know, we have to remember we're not all the same genetically or biologically. We don't all react the same way to use of pharmaceutical products like vaccines. And the bottom line is that the human right to informed consent to medical risk-taking should apply also to vaccination, use of vaccines, because that is a medical procedure that carries a risk. I think that doctors are making a big mistake to take a hardline position and not work with parents in a shared decision-making process, so that parents can trust and have confidence in their physician, that that physician is doing the very best, trying to work with them in terms of doing the best they can for that individual child. It's one thing to be an implementer of government policy that takes a one-size-fits-all approach to vaccination. It's another to work with a parent and try to make the best decision for a child who may have reacted to a vaccine and may be endangered if more vaccines are given. So it's really about, I think, between parents and doctors, shared decision-making.
Well, naturally, I'm going to want a response from Dr. Branco, but I have to say that you had pretty much stipulated that you wanted a one-on-one interview, which we've just given you, and you did not want a debate. And
I don't mind a debate at all. I think that the question was, in the setting of the program, was it going to be one to three, or was there going to, we would wanted another parent to come on with me. So
one of the problems with getting parents on here was they were making demands and commands in terms of how the configuration should be on the program. But I appreciate your forthrightness on this. And you will stay with us then?
I certainly will.
All right, let me go to Nelson Bronco then.
Sure. I actually would, and I am not all that interested in a debate with Ms. Fisher, but I do want to address a couple of the things that she's brought up. One is the issue of risk versus benefit and individual risk. I think that's something that as pediatricians, we spend a lot of time thinking about. The topic of this program, I think, can be boiled down to individual rights and risks versus the community's rights and risks. And in our practice, our policy was designed not only to protect children, but also to protect our community and our other patients. There isn't a pediatrician who would withhold or would force a vaccine on a parent where we thought that the risk of that particular vaccine would outweigh the benefit. I that's a strong statement, but I feel pretty confident in making it. And in our practice, we don't take a hard line on anything but MMR. We've looked at other vaccines. One of my newest partner, who wasn't around when we adopted this policy, emailed me just yesterday and said, have we thought about the DTaP, the pertussis vaccine? It's a reasonable question, be it based on the pertussis outbreak that we had in 2010 and another smaller outbreak that we had in Marin County just this past spring. That we decided that the MMR was going to be our line in the sand because the risk of that disease to our community and to our individual patients outweighed the risk of the vaccine.
Let me read these Facebook comments I alluded to here. We asked again, how did you come to your decision about vaccinating or non-vaccinating your child? And I want to give you some responses. Marty writes, vaccinating my children is a responsible thing to do. Yes, it could be my own personal belief that I do not want to vaccinate my children for whatever reason, but what about other people? If I kept my children at home 24/7, then my own personal beliefs might not have any repercussions for anyone else. But since I send my children out into the world, do I really want to be responsible for possibly spreading something like measles, chickenpox, or whooping cough to others? No. Jeff writes, our decision to vaccinate was based on the overwhelming evidence. It proves that vaccines save lives. Oh, and we trust our pediatrician. Melissa, on the other hand, says the vaccines are full of toxic chemicals. No, I'm not shooting up my kids with all that. Until more studies have been done, not paid for by pharmaceutical companies, and I am only selecting to do some vaccines and then only delayed. And Brian says many authorities now admit much, possibly most of the world's cancers come from the Salk and Sabin polio vaccines and hepatitis B vaccines produced in monkeys and chips. This is from realpharmacy.com. It is said that mesothelioma is a result of asbestos exposure, but research reveals that 50% of the current mesotheliomas being treated no longer occur due to asbestos, but rather the SV40 virus contained in polio vaccination. I don't know how we get at the heart of all that, of all those facts. Arthur Kaplan, maybe can you help us shed some light on that?
I think the link of cancer to SV40 virus is silly, absurd, and wrong. The link to cancers is smoking. If you want to find a target, all you need to do is look at China, where vaccination rates are very poor, and there are huge numbers of poor people, and they smoke, and they are ridden with cancer. So I think some of that is just internet silliness. Having said that, turning back around, I'll give you a case here to think about. So just recently, a non-vaccinator gentleman and went to the postnatal unit, the birth unit, newborn baby unit at a hospital in British Columbia. Turned out he had measles because he had been exposed somewhere else. He didn't vaccinate his family or himself. He exposed 60 pregnant women and newborn babies to measles. If one of those babies were to die, I don't say he's not free to do what he wants, but informed consent and choice carry consequences. If you go unvaccinated into newborn nurseries, if you harm somebody because of your choice, it is absolutely clear to me that you're going to have to be held or should be held accountable, liable, and responsible. We have a program that says we're going to help people who think they've been injured from vaccines. We also should have a stance that says, if you expose my baby and kill that baby due to your decision not to vaccinate against measles or other diseases, and I can prove that you are the source, that is going to generate liability. So I just wanted to make the case pretty clear about the fact that, sure, we have freedom, and I haven't argued that we're taking that away, but freedoms carry responsibilities. As the famous devotee of freedom, John Stuart Mill, once said, you can swing your arm, but your freedom to swing your arm ends at the tip of my nose, so that if you're hurting others or impacting others, that is going to be something we have to hold you to account for. One other comment. It is true that vaccines do fail, but they work better when most of us do it. The moral argument for getting vaccinated isn't just to protect yourself or your child. It's to protect those people that we've heard about, too, who can't vaccinate. There are certainly people who can't. We're all in agreement on that. The person undergoing the cancer treatment, the person who's post-transplant and immunosuppressed, the child who has different genetic conditions that make it impossible to generate an immune response. Those people are all out there. They need protection from us. We're the infectious agents. So when you think about what's your moral responsibility here, it isn't just I have to do the best thing for my child. You're also thinking I have to do the best thing for the child across the street, the person who's in the nursing home, who if I give them flu, I'm likely to kill them, the person who has a baby who has all kinds of immune diseases. It's a community responsibility. I think we haven't heard that ethic brought forward. Vaccination isn't just about protecting yourself. It's about protecting your neighbor.
All right, again, Arthur Kaplan directs the Division of Medical Ethics with the NYU Langone Medical Center. Excuse me. I want to get our callers into this. And Jeremiah is with us first, and he's a parent, so I'm glad to have him, who is following an alternate vaccine schedule. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. So my question, I did a lot of research when it came time to vaccinate my daughter and read different books and stuff. And the issue that I saw kept coming up was that more of the issues happen when you combine the shots together. And that was, you know, they said it was probably because of the overtaxing of the immune system. And that was one issue that I read. And so I've chosen to break out my shots for my daughter one at a time. And then the other thing that I came up upon, which was pretty scary, is all the lobbying and money that was spent by the drug companies to essentially make them judgment-proof if they have any errors in their vaccines. And that leads me to the question of, wow, if there's that much been put into it, then you know, why was that? You know, what's the risk there?
Catherine Martin, can I go to you on this?
Let's see. First of all, on the...
Well, talk about the separating first, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to talk about that first, the separating of the vaccines. Basically, that just... There's no evidence to support that separating vaccines is going to result in anything but extending the amount of time that a child is exposed to these diseases. And actually, there are studies and literature that supports how much more traumatic it is actually for children themselves. If parents are worried about their child and the impact of their emotional, you know, of getting shots, you know, they're getting that many more shots by spacing it out. So it's a choice. If a parent wants to do that and their insurance and everybody's in agreement that that's the way they want to go, that's fine. But it really only extends the amount of time that they are exposed to, that they're susceptible to disease, and makes it much harder on the child and the parent to have to take that time. The children can handle much more than they are getting within these vaccines. And indeed, they get less than they used to. We don't get smallpox anymore, and smallpox had a large amount in it, but the doctor could speak to that as well.
Well, I'm looking at a listener here, John, who writes, the vaccine regimen for infants is striking. It's hard to believe that you can pump a baby with so much aluminum with no consequences.
Let me just jump in here and say some of this discussion is a little bit off the real world of what babies or newborns or children or you and me get exposed to. If you put the baby on your rug, the number of viruses and bacteria that they're going to be exposed to, plus mercury and any number of other stuff, is beyond measure compared to what they're going to get out of a vaccine. If you let the dog lick them, you're really in trouble here. The point is, the world is a pretty nasty place full of a lot of noxious agents. Vaccines try to use small amounts of things to trigger immune responses. But the world out there as it is, there's plenty of things out there conspiring to kill us.
Let me get a response actually from Barbara Lowe Fisher on this.
The root of vaccination, vaccines are injected into the body. You know, when you're on a rug and you inhale, it is not the same as injecting lab-altered viruses and bacteria, as well as chemicals, et cetera, into the body. So I don't think that that argument holds any water. But also, I think it's really important to point out it is illogical to hold individuals who do not get vaccinated for passing on infection when the companies are not held liable. If the vaccine fails, and it often does fail, for example, with pertussis, and not hold them accountable for vaccine having their product not be effective enough. So I don't see how you can hold parents accountable.
I know you didn't want to debate, but trust me, if you inhale it, lick it, inject it, it's all headed to the same destination.
It does not process in the body the same way.
Well, we've got a doctor here in studio with us. You want to weigh in here, Nelson Brangwell?
Well, I think actually my perspective on both of those is that they're both boogeyman arguments. Whether you ingest it, lick it, there's more aluminum in breastfeeding over the course of a year than there is in the vaccine schedule as currently laid out. And so we can look at all that. But for me, it comes down to data. Is there data that the vaccine schedule, as currently recommended by all the authorities, the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American, the ACIP, is there data that that causes harm? And there just isn't data. Yet there is lots of data that there are decreases in vaccine-preventable diseases. The issue of spacing out vaccines, our practice, we do work with parents who choose to space out vaccines. We do believe that we can get more kids fully vaccinated if we work with parents and address their fears and share information with them.
It's been your experience, anecdotally, I mean, but nevertheless your experience, because there is this assembly bill that's created a great deal of controversy. It goes into effect in January that says parents have to meet a health practitioner if they're going to opt out. I want to get more calls on, though, and let me get... Jennifer is our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm a parent, and I'm also a pretty informed consumer around scientific literature and child development literature. I'm a research scientist in developmental psychology, and I am able to read and understand the research, and I feel like a lot of the conversation around this issue has been about, well, if parents only knew, you know, if they only knew, if they only understood, they would make the right decision. It's all about reason and it's all about data. And as much as I wish that were true, and I feel like the data is really, really strongly on the pro-vaccine side, and I did vaccinate my children, I feel really strongly that everybody should vaccinate their children unless their child has a health condition or a medical condition. I've gotten into fights with strangers at parties on this issue. But when it came time for me to vaccinate my girls, even though I know the research, I believe the research, I feel passionately about this, it was really hard. I had to physically steel myself and kind of repeat this mantra that, like, I am not harming my children. I am not harming my children.
That's the because you know that there's, I mean, in your mind, there's stuff going in their body that, and what parent is not suspicious about what's going into a body with a needle? And yet you know the science is there, right?
Yeah, like it was not a rational question. I had rational or scientific or, you know, what I thought of as a reasonable objection. It was just scary to think, like, just to have that fear of, like, the tiniest possibility. You know, what if it just so happens that this is going to be one of those weird times when you're in that 0.0001% probability? You know, so I think that the... It isn't only a question. Of course, people need to understand the data, and they need to understand the strength of the support behind the data supporting that vaccines are safe and effective and, you know, can prevent harm not only to your own children and family but to the community and to others and all that. People need to understand that, but there also needs to be an acknowledgement and that even once you understand that, it still can be an emotionally fraught thing.
Well, I thank you for your candid ambivalence. I appreciate it. I'm sure there are a lot of parents who feel the way you do, and I thank you for that call. I want to find out, again, go to some more calls, but what some of you are writing to us on Facebook and on the web. Paula writes, I consider vaccination good citizenship. Most people that tout the line about toxic chemicals can't explain the reaction of baking soda and vinegar. You don't have the right to use pseudoscience to opt out of the herd and then send your child to the public school and put everyone else at risk. Jen writes, my eldest had seizures after 6-month DPT, which stands for diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus vaccine. I delayed vaccinating the rest, although I'll out and out refuse the chickenpox vaccine. It's a really, really stupid one. Barbara says, clearly these people have not watched children die of complications of both measles and mumps. I have in the 60s when there was vaccine only for rubella and nothing else. They don't recognize child diseases can be deadly. Jeffrey writes, it's important to internalize the cost of choosing not to vaccinate. Should we segregate children without full vaccinations into separate schools so that vaccinated students and those who cannot vaccinate because of health reasons are not exposed to the choice of others? Another listener says, if parents want to take a chance with their children's health, maybe it should be up to them, although maybe they should have to pay for all the treatment if their child gets polio or some other serious preventable disease. However, no child who has not had vaccination should be allowed to attend a public school. There should be no exceptions, period. You can see how strong the passions are here. Another listener writes, I'm not opposed to vaccinating children, but the frequency and amount of vaccines that children are expected to receive by 6 months, I don't see why very young children should be expected to get varicella and hepatitis B when they won't be at risk for those diseases down the line. Why not give very young children pertussis, MMR, HIV, polio, vaccines that are relevant to their young health and space out the other vaccines until their immune system is more developed? And Jordan writes, is that irrational pseudoscientific celebrity spoke idiots like Jenny McCarthy, in the interest of balance, given platforms to expound positions that are the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater? Here's the bottom line. Vaccinations are the single greatest advance in public health ever, bar none, minimal risk, and incredible benefits. Another listener writes, perhaps the 3-in-1 vaccine should not be used, but there should be 3 distinct vaccines. Is that part of the answer that would reassure parents? And let me go to more calls because I could read these all day. Lindsay, hi, join us.
Hi, I'm a parent as well, and I am concerned about the over-vaccination that I see going on. I don't have any, you know, belief that vaccines don't work. I don't believe vaccines cause autism, but I do feel like we're giving a lot more vaccines than we used to. For example, chickenpox. I was not vaccinated for chickenpox as a kid. Me and all my friends got chickenpox. None of us were concerned about dying back then. So my question is really about, I'd like to rephrase the conversation in terms of not the risks of vaccines versus the risk of getting these diseases, but the risks of having serious complications from these diseases. And so I'm hoping I can get some input from your panel specifically about MMR. Obviously, I believe that the vaccines would work against the diseases, but I really want to understand the risks of the serious complications from MMR versus serious complications from the vaccine.
How do you come down on that, Barbara Lowe Fisher?
Well, I come down on the fact that you have to consider each child individually. I know Dr. Kaplan argues for the collective versus over the individual. I argue the opposite. And I think that we have to look at the fact, and I'm going to quote the Institute of Medicine 2013 report, although each new vaccine is evaluated in the context of the overall immunization schedule that existed at the time of review of that vaccine, elements of the schedule are not evaluated once it's adjusted to accommodate a new vaccine. Thus, key elements of the entire schedule, the number, frequency, timing, order, and age of administration of vaccines, have not been systematically examined in research studies. End of quote. It is the gaps in the science that is concerning the educated parent. The parent who goes in and does the research, because right now on the Library of Medicine is available to us on the internet. We can go in and read the studies. And it's the gaps in science that are the problem here. Once those gaps are filled, we're going to have a lot more information about how to screen children out, for example, with MMR vaccine or any other vaccine. We're going to be able to make better decisions.
Arthur Kaplan, want to comment?
Well, I don't argue that the collective should dominate the individual. What I argue is that the individual should take into account consequences for the rest of us. So responsible choice isn't just, I do what I want and to heck with everybody else. Responsible choice is, I have to think here, what's best for my child, and I worry about putting foreign things and giving a child a shot even, which a lot of people don't like, but I understand that a lot of things in medicine are going to be putting in things, drugs, medical devices that we don't like. They're foreign objects, but they help. And the data, in one sense, is overwhelming on the side of doing the vaccine for protection. But if you choose not to, what about harm to others? Aren't you then responsible if you go places or expose people? Aren't we going to hold people to account for individual choice? That's what individual choice is all about. It's responsible choice, not reckless choice.
All right, I want to thank the caller and read some more remarks. Kevin says, I'm 54 years old, had a bad reaction to the TDAP 3 years ago. I find it problematic that the CDC doesn't seem to track adverse reactions. I try to report my bad experience, but couldn't find anyone willing to take or listen to the information. And another listener says, I'm not against all vaccinations, but feel that the statistics are incomplete at best and definitely skewed. Those kind of remarks, Catherine Martin, I mean, can you address them for us?
Well,
nobody's listening, nobody's taking data, and the statistics are not complete.
Well, as we've heard on the call from the callers from Ms. Fisher and the experts that you've assembled on this call, there is a diversion of opinion on this, but as the coalition, we go with the data from the CDC, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, the Institute of Medicine. All of these groups are in agreement that vaccines save lives, that vaccines are safe and effective. Yes, there are potential risks. Everything has a risk with it. There is nothing with zero risk. And one of the things I want to get back to, if possible, is to emphasize that the majority of parents believe immunizations are important and they trust their health care provider as a trusted source of information. Despite this, we are seeing in California, for example, and other states like Oregon and Washington, a huge increase comparatively of parents who are opting out exempting their children from vaccination because of those fears and concerns and those what they perceive to be inconsistencies in data. And so that's why we ran this legislation last year and were successful in creating a new...
You're talking about Assemblyman Pan's bill.
Right, Assemblymember Dr. Richard Pan, that will require parents to have a conversation with their physician, their nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, naturopath, or school nurse to ensure that they're getting their questions answered before they opt out of vaccination. Because, and this is before they can enter into child care or school, because we have no illusion of changing minds of people who are anti-vaccine, but we want to be able to address the concerns of parents who are vaccine hesitant, parents who are vaccine concerned, may not have gotten the answer from their doctor. Some people are intimidated by their doctor, don't get enough time with their doctor, don't see a doctor regularly. So they'll be able to talk to a school nurse or somebody else in a clinic about this.
Yeah, but you have other celebrity spokespeople like Rob Schneider, who says, in effect, you're trampling on his personal rights to be a parent by requiring him to go to a health practitioner. Why should the state make that incumbent upon him? Dr. Bronco, you want to say?
I think that the state has every right to ask you to get good data to base your decisions on. And, you know, again, we can debate the rights of the individual versus their duty as a member of the community. But certainly as a citizen, we should base our decisions on good data. I'd also like to, if I could, address the comments of there is nowhere to report adverse events. And that's not true. And I'm sorry that that caller or person who wrote in couldn't find information. There's a VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, is a very robust database of any adverse event that might be related to a vaccine. You can Google it. You can get information from your doctor.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Branco. Thank you, Dr. Kaplan. Thank you, Catherine Martin. Thank you, Barbara Lowe Fisher. And thank you, our listeners. The debate will continue. In fact, you can continue this online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. And another hour ahead, we're going to talk about aging out, a problem particularly some feel in Silicon Valley. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, and Katie Sprenger. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our interns are Keelan Cronin, Evelyn Wang, and Margot Witt. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.